Greetings, and welcome to the Virtus Capital Markets Overview conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, April 15th, 2020. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Barry Mandinack. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. This is Barry Mandinack, Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners, and I'd like to welcome you to our quarterly capital markets overview call. Today we'll be featuring Joe Terranova, Senior Managing Director and Chief Market Strategist at Virtus Investment Partners. Joe represents Virtus as a client-facing thought leader, providing insight into the domestic and global investing landscape. Joe is also a CNBC Ensemble member, appearing regularly on the Halftime Report, Squawk Box, and as a contributor of financial content across CNBC's media and digital platforms. Joe, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Barry, and thank you for having me on the call.
Okay, great. What I thought I'd do is lead off with a few questions, give you an opportunity to respond, and then open it up to the field for their questions. So obviously, any call that we're going to start with today, we're talking about COVID-19 and the impacts that it's having on the global markets here. I know some are comparing the current environment to 1929, but since that comparison has taken place, I know the S&P's rallied north of 27% or so. So from your perspective, how do you see things today as it relates to the markets and COVID-19?
Well, let's provide the evidence for those on the call so that they can go out and properly communicate it when clients have questions surrounding the comparisons between 1929 and 2020, because there are still comparisons that are being drawn. So the single comparison relates to studying the history of the market and the fastest 30% drawdowns in markets. And for those of you on the call on Virtus's website, there's an excellent piece that defines the largest 30% sell-offs and the duration of their occurrence. So if you take the five fastest 30% drawdowns in the history of the markets, coming in at number five is 1987. What the first and fastest drawdown has been is the 22 days in 2020. It took the market to go from February 19th to March 23rd, 22 trading days down 30%. In between there, there's three incidents, 1934, 1931, and 1929, where markets went down 30% on somewhere between 23 trading days and 30 trading days. So it feels, Barry, in terms of the heightened sense of urgency, the extreme volatility, and the rapid decline like 1929. But here's the evidence why it's not. And the evidence is about the mosaic of coordination that investors have supporting them right now. That mosaic of coordination was 180 degrees different in the atmosphere of 1929. And I would argue the absence of mosaic of coordination in 1929 actually was the catalyst for the Great Depression. So fiscal support has been given in 2020, 10% of GDP. I'm not going to use the word stimulus. I'm going to use fiscal support. What was offered back in 1929? What was offered in 1929 was Republicans and Democrats in a unified capacity seeking to reduce size of government, seeking to reduce spending, and introducing Smoot-Hawley. When Smoot-Hawley was introduced in 1929, what followed was a 60% reduction in exports and imports to Europe. Additionally, 2020, we have the infinite Fed that is providing massive liquidity to the capital markets. And if you study the capital markets, you'll find that anytime liquidity is being provided to the capital market structure, it acts to nourish risk assets over the next 3 to 5 year period. That's the 2020 environment. 1929, Barry, you had a monetary policy that was not accommodative, but was actually tightening. Fed funds rate at that point was 6%. The monetary base in October of 1929, for everyone on the call, please write this down, was $7.35 billion. The monetary base should expand in response to a crisis. The monetary base 1 year later had contracted 7% to $6.8 billion. So, Barry, a completely different environment that was witnessed in 1929, the lack of action led to the Great Depression. 2020, the mosaic of coordination will ultimately lead to the destination of this being a great opportunity.
Oh, that's great, Joe. I mean, it's interesting that if you look at money market flows in March, net flows of $685 billion, which was an all-time record. So many reacting to the precipitous nature of the decline went to the sidelines, and now an advisor is trying to think about how do you work on a portfolio today for people who are nearing or in the early stages of retirement, given what's going on. What would your thoughts be on how to look at portfolio construction in the wake of the last 45 days?
So the environment, which I would define as a rush to safety, pivoting from your comments about money market funds, rush to safety, the world chasing the ultimate safe haven, which is a U.S. Treasury or the U.S. dollar, the world short U.S. dollars. What do you do in that environment? Well, you create a repricing of certain asset classes that one could argue were valued expensively prior to this incident. And then you also do two things. You place quality on sale and you place diversification on sale. And I think that's the opportunity for the advisor on the call today to look at the four components of diversification that's been placed on sale. Look at it by asset class. Now also look at it by geography. Think about it by equity size class. Understand that while it feels awful to talk about small caps or even mid caps in this riotous environment, know that the eight instances since 1980 of a 20% correction in the equity market, in each one of those instances, the recovery over the following 12 to 18 months was led by small caps. Think about mid caps and about the fallen angels out of the large cap equity construct and the opportunity that they provide. So asset class, geography, equity size class, and lastly, strategy. I think strategy becomes incredibly important. You're going to be looking forward to an environment where equities will lose the hand underneath the market that was corporate buybacks. Corporate buybacks will be lessened by at least 30 to 40% over the coming 12 to 18 months. Without that hand underneath the market, I think that leads to an environment of not so much, Barry, higher volatility, but more risk assumption on the part of investors. And when you're assuming more risk, a passive investive strategy, which has been defining the last 5 years, I don't think that's going to be the most prudent strategy to be applied in this market. I think active as a strategy makes a very significant return here in the absence of those buybacks.
Okay, that's interesting. Another thing, as FAs look to rebuild the equity allocations to many investors who have been a little bit disenchanted with stocks given three major bears in the last 20 years. I've heard you talk a bit about using high yield as a way to position people for additional risk-taking and return generation, but maybe less risky than equities. Can you talk about that, please?
Well, I think you need to think about the markets on a valuation and a risk perspective. And what I mean by that is I'm going to be on CNBC tonight on the 7 p.m. show, and one of the things I'm going to talk about is the S&P appreciating from 2191 up to 2851, which is what it's done from March 23rd to April 14th. S&P above 2800, it clearly forces an environment where you look at the opportunity in equities, you measure your risk-reward balance, and then you look at the opportunities that are presenting themselves in the credit markets. I use as an example the financial sector. Look at how the deterioration in the equity valuation for financial institutions are right now, but the opportunity really is on the debt side. Why? Because it's all about the balance sheet and about building the reserves on the balance sheet and where is the support being lended. It goes back to the infinite Federal Reserve and the 18 steps that they've provided since March 3rd to provide liquidity and support, whether it be the commercial paper market or ultimately, which was the greatest weapon last week in supporting the corporate bond market. So that corporate bond market has repriced itself, Barry, and I think that's where the opportunity is, and I think that opportunity strengthens itself even more now that you've got the significant appreciation on the equity side. I think investors from a risk-reward standpoint do themselves strong justice to look at credit markets first.
Okay, great. Operator, what I'd like to do is open it up to the field for questions, please.
Certainly. One moment, please, for the first question. Our first question comes from the line of Ethan Lowen. Please proceed with your question.
Hello. Thank you for the phone call. Very helpful. I guess the question that I have is referring to debt. I guess with what the Federal Reserve has done and causing things to be repriced, how much of a floor is there if this were to continue? And what you hear about with the number of mortgage holders that are not paying their mortgages, you know, they're taking advantage of the program and commercial, you know, businesses, small businesses that, you know, are deferring paying loans and small businesses that can't pay rent and the effect that has on REITs, et cetera. I guess how much of a buffer is there in the system that could cause that to become an issue, whether it's a financial crisis or whether it just causes a liquidity event but slows down the recovery, slows down growth. Has that really been taken care of? And if not, what is the limits? Are we talking a month, 2 months, 3 months?
Well, first of all, Ethan, thank you for your question. For everyone on the call, I enjoy this part of these dialogues the most where we have the opportunity to communicate with each other. Ethan, I hope you and your family are doing well and that you're safe. As it relates to your question, I think what the Federal Reserve has successfully done in these series of steps that began March 3rd with the 50 basis point cut and on April 9th resulted in the $2.3 trillion lending program is they've taken the systemic risk out of the credit market. Again, I mentioned before the need for active management in this. You mentioned the mortgage construct. I'd be less inclined to mine for opportunities in the mortgage market right now. I'd be more inclined to look at the asset-backed component of the credit market. I'd be more inclined to look at select construct of the investment grade market or the high yield market. I'd be more inclined to look at the municipal bond market, which will see a return of revenue once again. And I think on a selective basis, as Dave Albright from New Fleet Asset Management pointed out to me, in most recessions, what follows on the other side of recessions is a slight uptick in tax revenue. Well, that obviously supports the municipal bond market. So to answer your question, I think the systemic risk, which is in its singularity most important, has been removed by the Federal Reserve. You rightfully present that this could extend for a duration far longer than the market would be comfortable with. I would offer to you in that environment, the Federal Reserve can then show the capital markets the ultimate weapon that they have when people challenge them whether they have enough, and it's two words. The ultimate weapon is printed. And that's exactly what the Federal Reserve can and I believe would be doing in that situation. So further liquidity, if needed, can be provided. I think you have to be selective in looking for these credit market opportunities, but the systemic risk, I suspect, has been removed by the actions taken by the Federal Reserve to date.
That makes sense. If I could just ask a follow-up question.
Sure. Great.
Less directly related, but if that's what it's come down to is the Federal Reserve, you know, printing it. And I guess, you know, are we now effectively in the environment that Europe has been in for whatever 6 years and Japan has been in for 20 years, which ultimately seems to have led to lower, you know, substandard debt-fueled growth and historically low PE ratios despite quantitative easing, asset purchases, et cetera. Is that where we're at? Is that where we're headed? And I guess just your thought on that.
So let me tell you why we are not and will never be where Europe is at. In fact, I would argue of all the opportunities that I look as a capital markets investor, I see Europe as presenting the least opportunity. I think Europe has to make a very difficult decision whether to stay unified, if you could even argue that they are, or not. We are distinctly different from Europe, and why I mentioned before, I used the words the great opportunity. I think for everyone on the call, please understand this is a journey that we're going to go through. It's a mosaic of coordination involving fiscal, monetary, and healthcare support. All of that collectively is something that's uniquely different than the experience of what's going on in Europe right now. But where we're different is that on the other side of this, what quickly returns, what's highly visible once again, was what was the excellence coming into February of 2020 for the U.S. and what was unrivaled in the rest of the world. Think about what the U.S. was. The United States had transitioned its economy, okay, in the single greatest transition, rather, since the 1950s, into a technology-oriented economy. Think of all the technology companies that we have. We export software and services. We do it better than anyone else in the world. As I often cite, Israel is the second leading exporter of technology. Secondarily, while we're cyclically challenged by the price of oil, we're secularly benefiting from our energy independence. So combine a technology economy with energy independence and point me to the economy anywhere in the world that can rival that. They can't. And lastly, it's the U.S. consumer and the strength of the U.S. consumer. The U.S. consumer went into this in a very strong condition. Its balance sheet looked the best of all the three balance sheets, governmental, corporate, and consumer, first time we had that experience since 1991. And Ethan, I think that returns very quickly. And I would argue that Europe clearly doesn't meet any of those three criteria, okay? It is competitively imbalanced relative to the United States and the excellence that was the U.S. economy. I think that visibility comes back on the other side of this very quickly and first and foremost before other nations.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you. Appreciate the insight.
Our next question is from the line of Marty Perez. Please proceed with your question.
Thanks again for the commentary. I had a question. What keeps you up at night? What keeps you up at night?
Well, we recently got a Labradoodle, so that's the first thing that keeps me up at night. But and she's adorable. But, you know, listen, I've been doing this 35 years. What keeps me up at night is worrying about the health of my loved ones. And I think as you progress in the industry, you understand that that's the priority. And if there's anything about this experience, that's what I think we're all being taught on a very personal basis. I have one sister who she and her husband, they own a dry cleaning business, so you know the challenges that they're facing right now. I have other people that are close to me that are in small business for a living. I'm an investor in a restaurant. So I think there's a higher priority of needs that we all are focusing on right now. As it relates specifically to the market, because I don't want to dance away from your question. I think what would trouble me most, looking forward is the inability for there to be some form of unified response as it relates to healthcare. What I think has been incredibly remarkable, and I had the opportunity with my kids to watch the movie Midway over the last month, and I recommend to anyone on the call, go watch the movie, it's great. But the Japanese during the movie say, we've awakened the sleeping giant. And I think we've awakened the sleeping giant here in the United States, but not politically and not in the construct of our public officials. But I just think it's the American citizenry that we've awakened. And while we are very complicated in our nature as a society, when there is a unified effort that's needed, we're very simple in our effort and we have a tendency to achieve it. So the lack of unity moving forward in a healthcare response, I think would trouble me most, because I think clearly that would lead to a second incident either in the fall or the winter, less of an ability to mitigate those circumstances. However, I'm optimistic that that won't happen. I think we stayed unified in our effort. I think from the healthcare standpoint, we stay unified in the effort. And I think if there is a second incident, we're going to know, we're going to have the tools and the therapeutics to mitigate it. So as it relates to this crisis of preservation, that would be what keeps me up at night.
So
and just to add upon that, if I could, I think for all of us, we get the most degree of comfort from our public officials, and I'll cite Democrats, Republicans, let's push them to a side for 1 second, but we feel most comfort when we hear Dr. Birx or Dr. Fauci. I know personally at CNBC right now, one of the voices that I respect most and I try and get as much of his time privately as I can is Dr. Scott Gottlieb. So it's that healthcare guidance that I think is so important, and we need to unify and be collaborative to whatever their messaging. And to date, we are. So I just concern myself that we stay disciplined with that adherence.
Thank you. So there's nothing really market-related that really keeps you up at night. It's really more something that would be like with healthcare or something away from the market. So,
okay, well, let me give you something in the market. I truly believe that I cannot tell you how much I applaud this Federal Reserve. And for everyone on the call that listens to that and we worry about the consequences of the Federal Reserve's action, okay, go put some gold in your portfolio, somewhere between 3 and 7%. Now we'll try and figure out whether we're going to stay in a sustained deflationary environment, we're going to have some massive inflationary spike at some point, which I would argue we would welcome given where we are, especially when demand evaporates for goods and services. But the Federal Reserve has supported asset prices, and I know they're there. And Chairman Powell in his communication and his actions has ensured the investment community that this is a friendly Fed. If there's one construct of the capital market, okay, to answer your question that I'm concerned about, it would be the pricing of oil. And the pricing of oil is not so much an equity concern. It's not even so much a high yield concern, because the last time the energy market dealt with sub-$35 oil was 2016. Private equity and, to a lesser extent, the banking community stepped in with rescue financing. The rescue financing has a five-year cliff, so it's a 2021 occurrence. What I'm most concerned about is the labor impact. Obviously, there would be a significant amount of jobs that would be lost if oil were to decline precipitously towards, let's say, $10. So in the construct of the capital markets, to answer your question, I appreciate your relentlessness in trying to get an answer from me. I applaud that. It would be oil prices first and foremost.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And then anything in outperformance from small cap in this environment since they've kind of really been hit when you look at the IWM?
So as I cited, small caps have led the recovery, okay, in every one of the eight instances where you saw a 20% decline for the capital markets. I would offer for everyone on the call, let's see a nice blend of small cap recovery. What do I mean by that? So small caps in the last couple of weeks, there have been moments where small caps have tried to advance higher. Obviously, today was an awful day for small caps. I want to see small cap growth, small cap value, a nice dispersion in the recovery come from that equity class size. I think that's an important indicator for everyone to watch. Have we gotten that just yet? No, we haven't. But you know what? That provides an opportunity for everyone on the call from a rebalancing standpoint. Remember, rebalancing, and Barry and I talked about this morning, rebalancing isn't supposed to feel good. Rebalancing never feels good. Rebalancing, you're supposed to be taking advantage of something that's in a stressed environment, okay? And it's probably going to feel like you made the wrong move for an extended period of time. But ultimately, it's going to help you achieve your goal and outcome when you look forward in your portfolio over the coming year. So as an indicator, I want a nice dispersion between growth and value for small caps in a recovery.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Frank McKinnon. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you. Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for being here today. I want to take you to a trading concept. Virtually every bear market has had a double bottom type move, you know, a retest. What do you think about that concept at this point?
The hard part is the market's moving so fast. Someone said to me today, is this truly a bear market? You know, year to date, well, today we're down 11.9%. You know, we've recovered so quickly. So it's very difficult to define this market. Look, my expectation as it relates to the need to retest the lows is that you're retesting the lows in an environment of high stress, that there is something that is coming that would impact risk assets that we have not seen. I would place a probability of that of less than 20%. I think that the known, okay, circumstances and the stresses thereof have been addressed properly by fiscal and monetary policymakers. I think we're seeing, and markets have been responded to first Italy as the analog and now New York with the appearance that there's a flattening of the curve. I would expect that markets, specifically the equity market, pause the rapid appreciation, at least temporarily, that they've had. You've had a 25% or 20 to 25% bounce from the bottom very quickly. I wouldn't be surprised to see the market, and I would argue it would be healthy for it to kind of trade within a range. But I would be very surprised if the S&P 500 retreated and significantly broke below that March 23rd low without there being something that is not known to us in incredibly stressful occurrence. Incredibly stressful.
Thank you.
There are no further phone questions at this time.
Joe, I'll just ask another question or two before we close it out, but you talk a lot about active versus passive. And the last 10 years has really been a great market, rising tide lifts all boats type of market. But now there's conversation about winners and losers in a post-coronavirus world. How do you see that playing out, and where do you see some of the winners and so forth?
Well, specifically on the equity side, it's going to lead to a very bifurcated market. So to the previous question from Frank, what I would add to what I responded to Frank is keep in mind, and I'm going to talk specifically about the S&P 500. The S&P 500 traded below its December of 2018 low, which was 2346, and got down to 2191. Keep in mind, it only traded below those lows for 2 days throughout the entire experience that we've had. Additionally, while the S&P 500 traded below those lows, quality, Barry, didn't trade below those lows. So you could look at Apple, you could look at Amazon, you could look at Microsoft, you could on the consumer side, you could look at Lululemon. In the financial sector, you could look at MSCI, which is the reporting agency. You look at Old Dominion in the industrial space, Old Dominion Freight Line. So quality never kind of broke below that December of 2018 low. So I think it's a bifurcated market, and let's just say that, you know, that less than 20% probability occurs and I'm wrong and we go below the March 23rd low. I'm not so sure that quality will spend much time below there. And I define quality in this bifurcated market as companies that have low debt levels, companies that will be able to have a premium paid for their franchise in the absence of buybacks, and companies that are delivering a product or service that is either essential or to a certain extent still desired in the COVID-19 in a COVID-19 environment. So it's those three conditions. It's the debt level, it's the ability to live in a world without buybacks, and it's really the ability to have the fastest return to visible earnings growth. That's the bifurcated market. That's quality. That's the construct of the market that I would focus on. And I think that's exactly what active management does, not only on the equity side, but on the credit side, and looking outside of the U.S. in the emerging markets, in the developed markets, even in the real estate market. I think REIT on the other side of this will have very strong performance. I think real estate domestically, while prices might be challenged in the moment structurally, there still is an absence of inventory in the United States. And I also think you're going to see a little bit of a transformation from the desire to have the urban lifestyle of the prior 5 years to more of the return of a suburbia lifestyle. So I would argue, especially given the low private sector borrowing costs that we're going to be blessed with, real estate, while you'll see a momentary price declines, I think there's still a secular tailwind behind that. And lastly, I would just say, listen, the Federal Reserve and their accommodative friend to the investment community policies, they're not changing that policy until the S&P 500 is either at, near, or above its all-time high from February. So you've got that supportive construct as well.
Okay, Joe, thank you so much. And I want to thank everybody out there for taking the time out of your day to join us. For additional market commentary and portfolio-specific insights, please visit our website at Virtus.com. If you have any additional questions or would like further information, please don't hesitate to give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. Everybody be safe. Have a good evening. Joe, thank you very much for your time today, and take care.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you, everyone.